Welcome to another episode of Building Black This Podcast. My name is Helen Little. I'll be your host, and today we are building with Sheila Thorne. She is the president and CEO of Multicultural Healthcare Marketing Group. Welcome to the show, Sheila. How are you?
I am well, Helen. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for taking time to be here and impart knowledge with all of us.
Well, I don't know how much knowledge, but I can certainly tell you what my journey's been like.
Well, that right there will suffice. So tell us, what led you to champion diversity and inclusion and health equity? I understand that it was a personal journey that led you down this path, but tell us about it.
Yeah, it definitely was a personal journey that impacted my passion for this. I started out as a French teacher. I taught middle school for 7 years and high school for 4 years. And I think that's what got me into the diversity cultural mode, if you will.
Okay.
When I left teaching and went into the business world, I really didn't know what I wanted to do. But I knew that the languages were going to be a vehicle of culture. We're going to be a vehicle that I could use. And my mom was a nurse. My sister was a nurse. And so when I started looking at pharmaceutical companies, I noticed, Helen, that they weren't talking to the people that had the disease. And that bothered me in terms of high blood pressure, diabetes, cancer, HIV, asthma. I knew that people who looked like me got it younger, suffered more, and died sooner. And I didn't understand why that was, living in this great country that we do. So when I got into marketing, I began to challenge our clients. I began to challenge my colleagues. Why aren't we doing programs in these communities? Why aren't we looking at how to health educate people so that they can take charge of their health? The answer I got was, those people are sick because they're poor. I said, wait a minute, not all of them are poor. We definitely need to help those who are underserved, but there are many people of color who have insurance, who have income, and they're still sick. They're still dying from preventable, manageable disease. So that led me to keep putting that on the table with the groups that I knew were the stakeholders that had the resources that could really focus on these populations. And that became my diversity package, if you will, in terms of helping companies understand these populations.
Well, I can tell you, I'm very glad that you have gone on this journey because it's obvious that we need it. And with COVID-19 being something that has affected all of us, and of course our community, differently, how has COVID-19's pandemic affected these disparities that you're already speaking of?
Yeah, these disparities have been around for a long time, for decades. And in terms of people of African heritage, for 400 years, the first time the first African set foot in Virginia in 1619, it has continued unabated, these disparities. And I think the other situation in my life that helped me to understand how important this was, my dad died of pancreatic cancer at the age of 47. Mm. My mom was 35. And so she raised 4 children in New York, chose not to go on public assistance, and health was always a part of that agenda. But with COVID-19, Helen, at the end of 2019, talking to my colleagues, I started hearing about this virus that was beginning to bubble up in Europe. And I talked to my public health friends. I talked to some other colleagues. I said, you know what? If this gets over here in the United States, we're in big trouble. We're in big trouble because we certainly, again, have more susceptibility to these diseases. But I wasn't seeing the data come out. Data didn't start coming out until March of 2020, shortly after the pandemic was declared. So that pandemic announcement just glaringly illuminated the long-standing inequities and inequalities, that not everybody was getting the treatment they needed, not everyone was getting the help and support they needed, infections higher, hospitalizations higher, deaths higher. So it really just affirmed what I knew was happening all along, that people of color, Black, Latinos, Native Americans, were gonna be devastated by this virus. And unfortunately, that has come to pass.
Well, there are even broader implications of disparities beyond COVID-19. What would you say they are?
Yeah, I think the broader implications kind of go back to healthy lifestyle. It goes back to what impacts behavior and health in these communities. And it certainly is insurance and poverty. Those two things are clear. But it's also what we are calling social determinants of health, transportation, education, safety, relationships with providers. The whole health system is not set up for people of color in terms of being user-friendly. So, you know, there's a saying in my business that the better predictor of outcomes is your zip code, not your genetic code.
That's it.
So where you live is really going to decide the quality of care you get and the accessibility of the care you get. So there's no doubt that location is a driver of health behavior. But there's another point, bias. Bias on the part of providers, bias on the part of our institutions, that systemic racism. So even if I do get to the hospital, I'm not necessarily going to be treated equitably as people from other groups. And that is persistent and pervasive in the system. It shocked people that healthcare professionals would have that bias. I mean, they're basically humanitarian. You know, they got into medicine to help people. But it's that implicit, unconscious bias that rears its head, and people are not even aware of it. Now, there's a whole lot of intentional stuff going on, too. But there is a whole body of evidence that people don't know what they don't know, and unfortunately make judgments about people who look different.
You know, it's interesting. I was just watching Michael Che, who's on Saturday Night Live. Mm-hmm. He has a new comedy show that's on HBO Max. And he dedicated an entire show to this, using comedy to show those disparities and how he was headed to one hospital, but his friend is like, don't take me to that hospital because, you know, they're not gonna treat me a certain way. And right. They'll call the ambulance because that's gonna cost $800 and I'm trying to buy a house.
Yes.
Like he in using comedy, he said, it's amazing how people would rather risk dying
yes.
than having to be strapped with bills or going exactly. to a hospital that offers greater care. And you've been doing a lot of work around COVID-19 hesitancy, which I thought was a really interesting way to put it. Yeah. And of course, in communities of colors, what are some of these issues that people are facing? I'm assuming getting vaccinated is one of them. Are there others as well?
Yeah, there's a huge amount of hesitancy, which they're now calling inquisitiveness. The fact that people of color have a lot of questions that are not being answered. There's a lot of misinformation out there. There's a lack of information out there. There's a basic mistrust, distrust of the sources of information. So having to talk to people of color who remember all of the medical abuses that occurred in the past. And although everyone points to Tuskegee, that wasn't the worst, Helen. There were many more worse than that. That had the most notoriety. But it really is a reflection of how this system, the healthcare ecosystem, has historically treated people of color. And the vaccine, urgent need for the vaccine, again, just glaringly illuminated that. People are now saying, well, what's in that stuff? Are you giving me the disease? Is it really going to protect me? Have you tested this vaccine in people who look like me? And quite frankly, they did a fairly good job. It didn't meet the percentage of the population. For example, you know, if blacks are like 13-14% of the population, only 10% of the people in the clinical trials were black, okay? If Latinos are 18% of the population, 11% were Latinos. And let's not even talk about Asian Americans or Native Americans. They almost didn't make it on the scale. Right. So that hesitancy is that realization of mistrust and distrust. Mistrust because historically the system has not treated us well. And distrust is because when we do trust them, we get treated badly. So we don't believe you anymore, okay? So that's unfortunate. And that's embedded in the psyche of these populations because it's not only historical, it's what happened yesterday when I went to the doctor, okay?
Yes.
It's what, you know, so it's contemporary. I've got two brothers and both of them have done well in life and one is a financial broker, one is actually in healthcare. They know when they go to the hospital, it's gonna be assumed that they're drug dealers. They won't get the same pain medication because it's thought that black people are easily addicted to drugs. I mean, all those stereotypes come to mind so that people say, you know what, I'm not going there. You know, I'll just do my holistic method. I'll just use some roots and herbs and some teas and, you know, I'll be okay. Unfortunately, those don't cure things like cancer or like HIV. It doesn't hurt you necessarily, but it certainly doesn't treat those chronic, life-altering, life-threatening diseases where you got to get to Western medicine and then hope for the best.
So we talk about these disparities in health and in healthcare for people of color and underserved groups, as you've mentioned, and that there are these longstanding challenges. But what do you believe needs to begin to close the gap? What do you believe needs to begin to happen to close the gap with pharmaceutical companies and healthcare institutions and the government in order for this to start to create some kind of balance in our structure?
That's a great question, and it's a very complicated one. I mean, the issues are complex, so the solutions are not going to be simple. But I think the basic foundation is education. Education about disease and about symptoms so that you get to the physician or to the healthcare delivery organization sooner rather than later. Much of what we suffer from, the mortality is high, even though the incidence may be low. That means late diagnosis. You know, so we get to the system when it's almost impossible to save us, and then the care becomes extremely expensive. So I think if more companies invested, and I mean invest, it's not a cost, invested in educating the community, then perhaps we could minimize the impact of these chronic diseases. You know, once you get high blood pressure, it takes a lot to reverse that. Lifestyle, diet, medication. But if you knew how to live healthily before that, you know, eating properly, not all the stuff we love to eat that's usually not good for us, maybe that would help minimize the impact. So start with education. And then secondly, help individuals in a cultural context take care of themselves. You know, we can't eat fried chicken, you know, fat back and collard greens and mac and cheese every Sunday.
Oh, they are so good.
Okay. Listen, if it tastes good, it's not good for you, Helen. That's a given, okay? and Blacks and Latinos and Asians eat very spicy food, sometimes very greasy food, but that's our preference. So you have to treat those like a delicacy. You know, one of my cardiology friends says, you can't have it every Sunday after church, but maybe once a month, okay? Maybe a special occasion. So nutritional advice, exercise, moderate exercise. We're not all going to run a marathon, okay? But we can walk 30 minutes three times a week, you know, moderately. And again, stress management. And that's a really important aspect because of bias, because of discrimination. We have a very different level of stress because it's something we're dealing with every day. And in fact, they have a new name for it, race-based traumatic stress. So it's like pressing your foot on the gas and never giving up, okay? It's not like stress you have if you lose your job or you lose a spouse. This is different. And that's when you have so much stress, your organs don't work very well and your immune system is compromised. So you're obviously more susceptible to disease. So if you have faith, that's one way to measure, you know, to minimize stress. So exercise is another way. I love music and dance. You know, when I get stressed out, I just put on my headphones and have a glass of wine and just kind of breathe. Okay. Everybody's got something, but we've got to learn how to manage that better because that stress can kill you. And that's something. So education, lifestyle changes, stress management, all of those things can go to a long way to helping people of color live longer and a better quality of life.
You mentioned, you know, I asked about the pharmaceutical companies and, excuse me, I asked about pharmaceutical companies and health institutions, government. When it comes to those who are leading their own businesses or who are in corporate America, knowing from all of the work that you've done with pharmaceutical companies, why is a diverse and inclusive environment important for these businesses?
Oh my goodness. Wow. I mean, you ask great questions, you know, and I don't know how much time we have, but let me talk about the pharmaceutical companies in particular, because that's where I had most of my experience. Historically, they've been reluctant and resistant to embrace diversity, not on the HR side. They get that. You know, you got to hire folks who look like the community, and that's a good thing to do. they haven't yet crossed the commercial side of the ledger, so that the clinical research has to be diverse. Their strategies and marketing have to be diverse. They need to put photos of people who look like the populations they're trying to reach. So it's got to be a broader based effort and not so siloed. But, you know, diversity, philosophically, people get it. They're tactically challenged. How do you do this? Mm-hmm. How much does it cost? You know, should it be Black? Should it be Latino? Should it be Hispanic? Should it be Latinx? They're confused, because they don't have that education. It's not diversity training, it's diversity education. That's transformational. If you can understand why me and Helen like collard greens, you know, you don't have to like them, but you need to know we do. And then you have to look at how it's cooked. You know, maybe we need to cook it in a healthier way instead of fat back with smoked turkey. You know, all those kinds of things, that cultural nuance and insight, most pharmaceutical companies don't know. And they need to understand that I'm going to have my preferences. I'm going to live my life as a woman of African heritage. It's going to be very different from your life. So how does your messaging have to be different? Can't just slap a Black face on a brochure and say, we did our bit. Okay. Right. and by the way, the Black faces they put on those brochures, most of them look Caucasian anyway. So they look white. So you got to have the full range of who we are as a people in terms of looking at that brochure and saying, okay, these people know who I am. You know, they were expecting me to pick this up. Right now, I don't think that is widespread enough in the industry to make a difference.
And that's the part of the inclusion side.
Yes.
That gets lost on so many people. Oh, you can have, like you mentioned, you can have HR very diverse, but if they're not included in the things that's going forward facing to the public.
That's right.
Your diversity is kind of falling on deaf ears.
Falling on deaf ears, and it's window dressing. It's not real. It's not genuine. Okay. It's just kind of check the box. And now they have another word, Helen, they've added diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging. Okay. I need to know, not only am I going to be hired, but I belong here. I belong here. It's not go back to where you came from. You know, I belong here. And now that justice is part of that equation too. Justice, equity, diversity, and inclusion. So I have a right to be here. I have a right to have the best quality of healthcare as you do. It's not about equality, it's about equity. There's a difference. And that's the kind of feeling you need to get from companies that are truly serious about diversity.
Well, what is your approach to understanding the perspectives of colleagues, partners, and employees from different backgrounds? You know, we all have to, I guess, find our way through that, but because it's part of what you do and you reflect that to other people, what is your process?
Well, that's a very good question. And I that question came to me, I guess, maybe 10 or 15 years ago doing this work. I said, okay, they're listening to what I'm telling them to do about marketing and advertising, but they don't know why they're doing it. So I started to do training. I started to do cultural competency training, cross-cultural education. Now, here's why African Americans have a strong sense of heritage and are proud of that. Here's why Latinos have a very different view of parenting and child rearing and so forth. So I began to develop curricula that would enable those who would be in the workforce or those who would be reaching out to these communities understand. And you don't have to have agreement. You just have to have understanding. You may not know why I do this. You just know that I do this and how that makes a difference in my behavior. So I started doing community mapping. Before I would go into a market, I would go in and I'd meet with the community leaders. I would talk to those that had a credible and trusted voice. And I'd say things like, I want to come in here and do a program on type 2 diabetes for Black women. Who needs to be in the room? Give me 5 names. And they'd give me the names. As I go through those people, Helen, the same names kept coming up. About those are the people we trust. They weren't healthcare professionals, by the way. They were community leaders who had the best interests of the community at heart. So I'd gather all those folks together and say, okay, we've got a problem. Type 2 diabetes is rampant in the community. It's costing the city, the state, a lot of money. And it's intruding on the quality of life of families and communities. We got to get a handle on it. So what do? And taking that information, I don't live in Chicago. I don't live in Atlanta, but I am a woman of color. So I understand some of the insights. Those are the people that I build my program around. Those are the people that I use in the commercials or the public service announcements or the community events. Pastor of the largest Black church, the publisher of the largest Black magazine or newspaper. They're the ones who have the name and the visibility. And I'd also go to elected officials. You know, they know where all the bodies are buried. Okay, so who's doing a program on diabetes? Did it work? Why didn't it work? So I guess what I'm saying is you got to do your homework. You know, you don't go in my community and impose a program. You collaborate with me and partner. And my saying is, nothing about us without us. So I want to be at the table.
I like that.
Okay? I want to be at the table and say, nope, not going to work. Once you do that, because I got to leave eventually, you leave behind something that can sustain that message and that conversation. And that's what I have found over the years really works. And when I suggested this to one client, the woman listened to me and she said, my, that's labor intensive. I said, yeah, all relationship building is. But once you do it, you definitely have the trust of the community. You have at least their willingness to make change and to save lives because they really want to live a good life. They just don't have the resources and the tools to do it. So I bring my pharmaceutical clients who have the resources. I work with the community who have the intelligence and the knowledge. And in a combination, it's a win-win.
So we're talking about primarily in this last part, for the most part, larger companies. What if you have a small company and you still want to use these practices? Mm-hmm. How can they learn from you, you know, things about belonging and equity daily and justice equity and the things that we've mentioned? How can they, if you're a small company and you really want to impact changes, how can they participate?
Yeah, you know, they can own something. You know, they may not be able to do what the multi-million dollar pharmaceutical companies can do, but in their own way, there's something they can own and there's something they need to embrace and stick with that, whether it's they do wonderful events and have a good draw of people that come. So that's an audience, okay? You have a signature event every year where everybody expects it and they want to be there, put health on the agenda. Have a physician or a nurse practitioner, and pharmacists. I work with them because they're sometimes, you know, the primary care doctors in poor communities. You go to the pharmacist and say, you know, what should I take if they can't get an appointment with a physician? So for a small company, use your assets to engage and dialogue with these populations, even if your company has nothing to do with health. Put it on the agenda. Get somebody there that can talk 10 or 15 minutes about untreated hypertension or the need for a mammogram or a prostate cancer test. And the organizations in the community, American Cancer Society, they've got brochures, they've got materials. Make those available to your target audience. Put them in laundromats, put them in beauty salons and barbershops. You know, saturate the community with positive information. Somebody's gonna pick it up. Right. And usually, you know, each one, reach one, teach one. So to your point, that's what doing the homework is about. You know, bring those groups together and say, well, what can you do with what you already do? And it really does enable you to be more creative about marketing. The advertising and the radio and the TV, that gets folks' attention, but you really need boots on the ground to meet people where they are. I always say high tech gets the attention, high touch makes it work. So in people of color, I'm gonna look at you across the table and say, is Helen for real? Okay, is she just fooling around? Then I know that I can trust her. She's got a voice that's credible and that's empathetic and compassionate. So again, they're in every community, Helen. I'm not making this up. I've worked in all the 25 markets in this country where you'll find most of these populations. The same strategies work. Even though they'll pull you aside and say, we're not like New York, you know, we're in Chicago, we're different. I said, yeah, okay, you are different. I say, but you were Black before you got to live in Chicago. So, you know, there are some common threads without stereotyping or without trying to minimize the person's individuality. But that's the fun to me, to go into these communities and learn I just did a program with the Native American community, the Shinnecock tribe out in Long Island. Learned phenomenal things about that population. And if you think they treated Black people bad in this country,
right,
that history is horrifying. But be that as it may, that was then, this is now. How can we help people? You know, tribes in the Southwest, some still don't have running water, okay? Mm. How can that be, living in this country where you have a third world country situation in this great country we live in? Something wrong with that. So, yeah. You know, and we got to fix that because they're entitled. You know, they were the only true Americans, quite frankly, okay? The rest of us are immigrants. But some of our folks have forgotten that.
Yes, they have. So if people, this has been so eye-opening for me, and I'm sure everyone listening. And if people want to find out more about you, do you have a website? How do they engage?
I do. It's pretty simple. SheilaThorne.com. Okay. SHEILA Thorne, THORNE.com. Just first and last name. Okay. You'll find my speaking engagements that may be coming up that you may want to take part in. You'll find some of the podcasts that I've done on various topics, increasing diversity in clinical trials. We just celebrated National Minority Health Month in the month of April, which was designated through a group that I worked with in Washington in 2005. So you'll find kind of the strategies and the skill sets and the connectivity that I have with ethnic populations, both consumer and medical. So SheilaThorne.com is where you can find me. And LinkedIn, you can find me as well. But I do a lot of speaking. I've been blessed, Helen, because I've never had to do cold call or mailings. I speak and people come. And so yeah. I'm blessed to have that gift to at least communicate what I think people need to hear. And I create a safe place for them to say some crazy things they think about race. My toes curl sometimes, but I let them talk.
You know, but at the end of the day, that's where progress starts, is where you feel safe.
You gotta face the problem before you can solve it. And we're not gonna solve it all. I mean, it's been a long time. We didn't get this way in 90 days. So it's gonna take a minute to straighten this all out and to raise consciousness of the problem even being an issue. When I talk to physicians, well-trained, well-traveled, educated physicians who have been in practice 30, 40 years, they're resistant to this cultural revolution because they have not had to have any education in that way. And one cardiologist said to me, he said, so now I've got to be an ethnographer on top of everything else.
Wow.
You know, I'm trained, I'm Harvard Medical School trained and MPH and MD and all that kind of stuff. And I said, yeah, you do. And he said to me in a group, I just want to treat everybody who looks like me.
Oh my goodness.
And my answer to him was white, bald, and Jewish. I don't think that's going to work. Okay. We don't have enough of those people around. But I said, doctor, I'm not being disrespectful. It's just that, you know, America has gone through a diversity explosion. And if you're not prepared and ready to meet and talk to and negotiate with people who don't look like you, I'm not quite sure why you got into medicine. Didn't you say you signed something called the Hippocratic Oath? First, do no harm. Okay. So I thought if I brought to your attention something that might be doing harm, you'd want to know. So that now they're it is powerful. I mean, and it's scary to a lot of people, okay? And I get that, but we've got to just change that mindset because these diverse populations are going to continue unabated. You know, before the middle of this century, one out of every two Americans will be a person of color or a person of color who speaks Spanish. So the so-called majority population is going out of existence. You know, the millennials, 44% of color, the most diverse society in American history.
Yeah.
So you've got to figure out how you're going to deal with these burgeoning populations that have culture and ethnicity that they're proud of, and they're not going to give that up. So how do you work with that? How do you negotiate with that is a challenge. Now there are about 15 states, the last time I looked, that require cultural training as a condition of relicensure for a doctor.
Wow, that's good.
So you can't get it. This is not an option anymore. they're seeing that your lack of knowledge is hurting people. So now they're requiring, and it's not just doctors, it's nurses, pharmacists, anybody that has face time with a patient has to have some cultural awareness training. And that's a good thing.
So slowly but surely, we will get there.
That's exactly right. I have a good friend who's from Ecuador, and he says, Señorita Sheila, yard by yard, it's hard. Inch by inch, it's a cinch. So, so you know, incrementally, we can do this. We're in the greatest country in the world with the most advanced technological, medical breakthroughs in history. We can do this. We've just got to do it together and not be divisive.
Sheila, thank you so much for, again, as I said at the beginning, imparting your knowledge. And if you don't think you got knowledge and wisdom, then you need to take a look in the mirror and check yourself.
Well, you're so kind. You're
so kind. Very powerful. Thank you so much for being on the podcast. And we wish you so much more success.